That's a song called Path of Least Resistance from the brand new album Imagination by singer, songwriter, musician, founding member of Moby Grape, Peter Lewis. And Peter joins us this afternoon. Peter, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, you're welcome. And here, let me turn this speaker off there.
Oh, yeah. Much better. That sounds great.
Okay. All right. Okay, we got it.
Man, the album is so good. It comes out officially on June 16th, but I have been enjoying it so much for the last few days. And the theme seems to be what we all know as we get a little older, that our time here is pretty short and all we really have are the connections we make with each other.
The music, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's what I do. It's just, And a lot of this was a collaboration with my producer, which is the best work, when you can both get on the same trip and do music, I mean, that's what Moby Grape was all about.
Well,
in the beginning.
And your producer, too, have been on our show several times, the wonderful John DeNicola, Oscar-winning songwriter. But it sounds like this was more of a collaboration between you two.
Well, yeah, the song you just played was, and the way we work is he sends me these ideas, when you're trying to do something like this, it's better just to start, with a musical idea, and then I get the musical idea from him, and he's usually got some kind of an idea for an arrangement, which means a progression of chords, and then I'll take that and try to shuffle around like in our machines. We can nowadays, one thing I do like about the digital revolution as far as music is concerned is being able to use your recording device like a word processor. So you can try stuff out, and if it doesn't work, just go to some other possible solutions for a problem as far as arranging, So I use these ideas he sends me, make them into kind of an arrangement, which means you have a couple verses, like the Beatles had that classic middle eight where they always have a repeating, so you hear the hook more than once,
The song
stuck in your head,
The song
we did that this way we can do it without having to sit there together and do it from coast to coast, where he sends me these ideas. I send the ideas back to him, what I come up with, and then I write some words to it, and that's what you just heard was just one of those.
And that song we heard, part of Path of Least Resistance, I understand that was inspired by some of the management issues that you had with Moby Grape and the long battles to maintain ownership of not just your music, but the name.
That's right. Well, I guess you could say it. They turned out to be that, It might have started from some other inspiration I had, but then it became like when I got into writing the song, which has to do with the way I do it with John as I go through it. I start singing something, and it's trying to channel an idea or get to something in the end where you it's about something. And I guess in the end it became about this guy that was our old manager, and that we were in a 40-year-long litigation with, the longest running music business litigation in history. And but the guy, he's passed away. I don't want to say anything too negative because he got us together. Okay, so life is like that, you get an opportunity to play with these great musicians, which is what my experience at Moby Grape was. I feel very lucky to have been playing with Skip and Jerry and Don and Bob, because they were great musicians. And now I'm the band is kind of, you never get out of Moby Grape, but we're not working anymore. Getting out there and singing. I just heard Robert Plant do one of our tunes last night. I was sent an email by one of the band members, old ladies, and she said, "You got to hear this." And I did the link, and it was Robert singing this song we did on our third record called It's a Beautiful Day that I didn't write, but I, you know, we all used to inspire each other to write about what was going on in our lives right then, you know. Moby Grape was more like, you know, like a thing that we were a consortium of songwriters where we all had, you know, we were willing, you know, to get together at some point in the beginning. And, you know, the idea was to figure out how to play songs, the songs that we wrote, better than nobody could play those songs that we wrote better than we did. That was our bar, you know, that was what we, the agreement between us, you know. In the beginning, when we did our first record, that's what happened. Through the rest of the career, you know, because we got famous so fast that it was that we didn't know each other that well, so, you know, everybody sort of got on their own ego trip. And then we got to a point where we thought the bar was not just figuring out how to play the songs we wrote, you know, in the best possible way they could be played, which takes it's a group effort when you're doing that, you know. And but when you get, like, a little bit of fame, somehow the ego, you know, comes, and then everybody is, like, you know, sort of trying to get everybody to play what, you know, there's a classic in the Beatles documentary, The Get It Back, where Paul's talking to George, and George, you know, that he can't please Paul. You know, he's one of Paul's tunes, and George says, well, look, I'll play anything you want. You know, let me help do anything you want me to do. And it's like, that's not what the Beatles did when they were first happening, because they were playing those songs. They were all in total agreement about how you played those songs that they made famous in the beginning, you know, which they got better songwriters, you know, but what they had is that thing, that agreement, you know, to play those songs that they wrote better than anybody else could play them, you know. And I think that's what Moby Grape did in the beginning, you know. And then we got sort of like a little bit too famous too fast, and then, you know, everybody wants to be the most indispensable member, you know, like, and that's what we get on the second record. But I heard that going on with the Buffalo Springfield too, who are our friends, you know. They were going through that, you know. And so, but anyway, this guy that was our manager, yes, the song was about him, you know, being this guy that sort of like, appeared to us as an angel, sort of father figure. He had been the manager of the Jefferson Airplane. We were not. I met this guy in L.A., you know, when I was playing with Joel Scott Hill, this other musician that was in playing clubs, doing cover tunes, and we were going to have a band that wrote songs, and you know, could play at venues like the Whiskey, or the Trip, which were better places than the place where I was playing. At Gazzari's, at that time, Gazzari's was kind of off the beaten path. You know, there was another band. Pat Lally Vegas was the other band that Gazzari played at Gazzari's, and mine, Peter and the Wolves. You know, actually, you know, Pat Lally became Redbone, and they had a hit, you know, with "Come and Get Your Love."
Right.
People, I still hear people playing it. You know, it's on the Muzak. You know, you go in here and come and get your love, you know. And I think of Pat Lally in those days. We were playing at Gazzari's. You know, they do a set, and then Peter and the Wolves would do a set. But it was, you're doing cover tunes, and you want to, you know, get you know, want to be part of the '60s, you know, especially with the groups out there that were like the Birds and the Lemon Spoonful. All these songs, the Jefferson Airplane too, you know, that were saying something about what was going on out in the world, you know, without not just entertaining people that were drinking, but, you know, really talking to an audience of people that were listening to them, you know, what they were saying.
Well, you were there. Moby Grape was there at a time when music really did change. I mean, when I think about the major bands that came out of California when you did, I mean, other than, you know, the Grateful Dead obviously was big, Quicksilver, Messenger Service, all these kinds of bands. One of the things that I found so interesting about Moby Grape, though, was you would look at a Moby Grape album, and just from the look of it, you sort of got an idea of what was inside. People talk about concept albums today and this and that, but it always seemed your early records were very cohesive, which for a group with that many songwriters must have been, that must have been very difficult to do.
Yeah, but I don't think it was all preconceived. I think it just like it was wanting to be part of something that was happening already, you know, for us in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Because we went to the Fillmore in Avalon, saw the Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane, and it was like just wanting to be a part of that, you know. I mean, how do you become a part of that? Well, you have to make yourself interesting enough as a person to get some attention, you know. I mean, that's what I saw them doing. You know, the Jefferson Airplane, you know, I mean, who are those guys that are up to doing that kind of thing?
We're talking with Peter Lewis here on Downtown.
Sort of serious about, and I think Moby Grape was an attempt to, of course, Skip had been in the airplane. And, he didn't really fit with them because the airplane, all of those guys were kind of people that knew how to, achieve a common goal without making every mistake that had ever been made by anybody else that had done this, that had gotten to where they wanted to get. I mean, they figured out how to get there without making every mistake everybody else ever made that was trying to get where they got, you know, or they were trying to get to, you know, like where they ended up, you know, not go through all the mistakes that were made to end up in this position where you got people listening to you, and because it takes some amount of this whole thing to me. It involved putting myself, becoming part of the subculture, you know, which is not like where I grew up, because I was the son of a movie star. So, you know, I got, you know, like it was a different reality.
Yeah. What was that like? For anybody who doesn't know, your mom was the wonderful actress Loretta Young. How old were you when you figured out that your childhood wasn't quite the same as everybody else's?
As soon as I went to school, you know. Before that, I thought everybody lived in the middle of Beverly Hills, you know. Servants in a pool and all that. You know, the kid doesn't know anything but what his experience of life is until he goes out in the world, you know.
And then you were in high school, I think it was some other sons of famous parents formed your first band, the Cornells?
Yeah, there were a bunch of other movie stars kids. That's what I'm saying, you know. You try to hang on to what you know as long as you can, you know. And so that was, the Cornells was fun. And I learned how to play because we got jobs playing at high school dances and we get work, you know. We weren't great. There were some other bands that were better, you know. The one of them in particular was this band called Heil King and the Newports. Heil was like a musical genius. He had these guys that were playing with him. And one of these guys was Henry Vestine, who ended up being in Canned Heat. So I knew Henry, you know, like when we were in high school playing in these different bands at dances. We knew each other. And, you know, then after we, I think it was like I got reconnected with Henry through my wife, who was cheating on me with this guy. See, the 60s was also about, you know, the freedom to just do what you feel like doing, you know, and letting somebody else do that too. You know, freedom, that's what personal freedom meant in the 60s.
Yeah. You played in Moby Grape, so many iconic venues, the Monterey Pop Festival, the Fillmore, but I understand that one of your favorite, most memorable shows was one you did at the Winterland Ballroom in 67, along with the Byrds.
Yeah, well, the Byrds, you know, of course, the Byrds were like the God complex for me. You know, they were telling the truth, you know, and doing it in that way they did it, which to me just captured the whole thing, you know. From it made sense of what was going on between the Beatles and the time they showed up. They were like, you know, the American Beatles to me. You know, I mean, they weren't doing just their own tunes, but, you know, when you hear that first lick of Mr. Tambourine Man, you know, sort of everything afterwards is gravy. You know, to me, the sound of the guitar, I mean, I hadn't heard that sound before. And I was like a guitar fanatic, you know. I loved the sound of rock and roll guitar players, you know, like James Burton. And, you know, him in particular was my favorite guitar player. And then McGuinn, you know. So when we play with the Byrds, it's like, it's a big deal for me. You know, and David Crosby came into the dressing room, and that was one of the best nights we ever played. And after our set, David, he just came and opened our dressing room door, stuck his head in, and said, "Wow," you know, and it was just a huge hit for me.
Yeah, you mentioned McGuinn, and
memory is one of those things. You know, you have these memories you have in life. You know, some of them good, some of them not so good. That was a good one.
Well, you mentioned McGuinn. He was on with us not long ago, and I went down to see his solo show nearby. One of the things that struck me about something you just said is that when you hear that Rickenbacker hit a note, you know who it is. You almost always know it's McGuinn. There's something about the tone and the playing.
Yeah, but I found out later. See, the only reason I got the guitar to sound like that, because the Byrds were signed with Columbia. And at Columbia, there was a union rule. The engineers could not push the faders up past 0 dB. And that means, for everybody out there that does recording, will know what that means. It's like there's absolutely no distortion. Okay? Because of the fact that they had Johnny Mathis, Doris Day, the distortion was the F word.
Yeah.
You know, so they didn't push the faders up past 0 dB. They were recording Jack Jones and people that were just that had to be heard in that sort of clear space Columbia that could create with the studios they had in LA, which were where all that stuff was recorded. You know, the Studio D and Studio A. We used Studio D when we recorded, but and Terry Melcher produced the Byrds. Okay, so Terry's father ran CBS at the time. So Terry could turn the faders up as much as he wants, you know. He doesn't care. He'd do it if the engineer doesn't do it. The engineer just goes sits on in the other room, and Terry does it, you know. And Terry was that kind of cat.
We're talking with
I knew him.
Talking with Peter Lewis. His new album is called Imagination. One of the songs I really love on the new album is called "Saying Goodbye."
0 dB, because if you don't. What you get is a bunch of signal noise on the rest of the track. You have to saturate that track with guitar signal without making it distort. And that's what he did for McGuinn. I mean, they worked on it a long time before they got it to sound the way it did when you heard it on their first single, you know, that song, Mr. Tambourine Man. But, I mean, they got that sound on his guitar. Nobody else could get that sound on their electric 12-string. Only McGuinn, because he got him and Terry figured out how to do it. You know, people go, "Oh yeah, you got it." You know, it was almost very scientific for a cat like Terry, but I think he didn't. He automatically knew that that's what you got to do to make the guitar sound big. The way it sounds is big. You know, like most guitars that you hear, you know, do not sound as some sound bigger than others, and the bigger ones are the ones that get the most attention. But it's hard to get the guitar to sound big. It used to be, you know, because of what you don't want on a vinyl record is that the signal that it creates or the vibration to knock the needle out of the groove. If you do that, you know, it's like the whole thing, I have to scrap the whole bunch of them, make another master, you know, and press another issue, you know. So, but Terry knew how to get it right there, or you didn't bounce out, and then she sounded bigger than any other of the guitar players. And you know, like, there's a different way to do it, and that has to do with where, how far away you put the mic from the amplifier when you're trying to record the signal, you know. The farther away, the louder you can turn the more signal noise, the more guitar you can get on the track. But then you have to record the guitar separately, you know, re-record it after the track has been made. And that's a different kind of recording, you know.
I wanted to ask you about one of the...
How great can we make this thing sound?
Right. You know? I wanted to ask you about one of the songs on the new album that I like a lot called Saying Goodbye. I understand that's about your first love, Kristen Harmon, who later became Kristen Nelson.
She was my wife. No, she didn't marry. She was my friend.
Right.
You know, my first girlfriend.
Yeah. First, your first love, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, what did she say? Oh, the song.
Yeah, Saying Goodbye.
The song was about, like, when she died.
Mm, because you two had reconnected, right?
Yeah, well, you know, she married Rick Nelson, my hero, because we broke up. Because she wouldn't put out, you know? You know, I mean, that's how you were when you were a kid. The girl had there were classic values going on. When we were growing up, it was still like it might as well have been the 1800s. You know, women didn't sacrifice. Well, they did more than they ever did used to. You know, I mean, and nowadays, you know, you like shaking hands. You know? but when I met her, it wasn't like that yet. So anyway, you know, we did this little dance. I'd bring my guitar over there and put it up in her basement and play her stuff I'd figured out. She sit there and listen to it, look at me with those dreamy blue eyes, you know, and that big smile on her face. I mean, you know, you would love her. She was beautiful, you know. So, but she married Rick Nelson. It's a funny story about Rick, man. There was a guy in our band, this guy Jim O'Keefe, who played sax in the Cornells, right? And he liked Chris, too. And he was way better looking than me. And he had a car, and I didn't. So he took her out in his car, and then they came back. She said she had a headache and made him take her home. And then, she goes in and says goodnight. And then Chris lived with her mom and dad and her siblings and her grandmother. Her mother, her dad's, I think, no, her mother's mother lived with them. And the grandma got Jim in there and gave him some cookies, and he was eating some cookies in the kitchen with the grandma. And then here comes Chris walking down the stairs with Rick. He was waiting for her in her bedroom, you know, like when Jim brought her home. She said she had a headache. And that's his memory of Chris. He was always mad at her, you know. But I ran into her again at some point, you know, and after the divorce and everything, and I saw her boys, the twins.
Yeah, Gunnar and Matthew.
There,
yeah.
The party was called Musicians as Artists, and I got in this book called Musicians as Artists because Mike Clark got me in there because I played with them. At one point, I played with Mike, and I sang because I was going to school. After Moby Grape, I went back and got a degree in studio art because I became interested in painting, you know. And so I did this painting of Michael called One Bird in the Garden. And it was this kind of beautiful, you know, little expressionist piece or something. And it was this little bird. My son made the bluebird by just, after I got the rest of it done, my son was like, two at the time, and he wanted to learn how to paint. He's like, dude, well, just paint. You know, I was just fooling around with this picture. You know, and he stuck the paintbrush in this bunch of blue and in some white, I think, and just stuck it on the paper and took the paper away, and it was a little bluebird. You know? and that was, I gave it to Michael after I played with them because I said, this is yours, man, because I realized that it fit, you know? It fit him, you know, One Bird in the Garden, because he was calling this band the Birds, but they weren't the Birds. It was him and with these other guys, and he called me and said, will you come down and play with me in Santa Barbara? And I did. And I must say it was strange. I mean, Michael got in trouble for doing that, and then Crosby and them, or he had been doing that, but he didn't stop. I mean, they were like, at each other, trying to make a living, Michael. You know, the Birds, the rest of the Birds weren't having a problem with that. you know, they had money.
Right, right. The new album from Peter Lewis is called Imagination. It's a great to have new music from you, Peter. I love it. It's officially available on June 12th, but out there on some streaming services already. Peter, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Well, you're welcome, man. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Peter Lewis, Moby Grape, and the new album, Imagination, here on Downtown. We will take a little break, 28 minutes after 5 o'clock on Downtown.
And because these daft and dewy-eyed dopes keep building up impossible hopes, impossible things are happening every day.
Hi, I'm Wesley Ann Warren, and you're listening to Downtown.